The advice and opinions expressed by the host of Autism Live and her guests are meant solely as suggestion and should not be in any way construed as child-specific advice. Any choices you make in determining your child's treatment are completely at your own discretion.
Good morning and welcome to Autism Live. I'm Shannon Penrod. So thrilled to be here with you on this Monday morning in sort of mid-July. It's the 11th of July. We're going to call that mid-July. So thrilled to be here. We're going to be live with you for the next hour. We're doing one of our parent-to-parent shows. These are specials during this summer that we are doing where it's information that's just from parent to parent. And today we're going to be talking about stimming, which is a very important conversation that I think that we need to have. We have this conversation a little bit all the time because you guys write in and talk about it a lot. I've got one eye allergy weeping. I'm not already crying. Don't worry. We're not going to cry today. We're going to celebrate, hug, empower, and find ways to be good allies today. That's what we're going to do today, but not going to cry. I don't think so anyway. In any case, we're going to be with you live for the next hour. The chat is open right now. We're live on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and about a dozen other places. And Traven will start to show that to you in just a second. All the places that you can be watching the show live. And don't forget the show. If you aren't able to watch us live, and most of you aren't able to watch us live, then you're watching us in podcast. And we love when you guys download and like and share the podcast, because it's the way that our information gets to more people. And that's why we're here. Our whole mission here is to provide information and inspiration. We've been doing that now for 11 years. And we're excited to be able to continue doing that on the Autism Network, which is where we have now found a home. And hopefully you guys are seeing some of the new programming that we're bringing to you on the Autism Network, which I'm really happy and proud of. But see, Traven's showing you some of the different places that you can listen to the podcast. It is a free download wherever you get your podcast. Programming note, a little over a month ago, we used to give you the option, especially on iTunes, that you could download the video or the audio podcast. And we stopped doing that because it's expensive. And we already have a place for you to watch the archived shows. All of the shows in their entirety are on YouTube. You can get them there. And we figure that those of you who are doing the podcast are watching the podcast. If you're watching it, you're going to be watching it from home where you can get YouTube, and YouTube works on your smart TVs now. Or you're listening to it when you're going for a walk or whatever. So we are only, hi, Badreddine. I hope I said that right. Hi from Morocco. And please write into the chat. Tell us where you're watching. You know, I love that. Christina Mills is with us this morning. Good morning to you. Because we've got a great topic today that we're going to be covering in toto, stimming. In any case, so if you want to watch the video podcast, please check that out on YouTube. Please subscribe, so we'll let you know when things are happening, and like, share, do whatever. But if you want to listen to the podcast, get it wherever you get your podcast. That's really what the speech is about. And if that's super not working for you, can you please let us know? Because we make decisions based on what we hear from you guys. And if we don't hear anything, we assume that everybody's okay. Carolyn, Toronto. So, hey, so excited that you're in the house. You know, we've been finishing watching up The Boys, which is all shot in Toronto, and we're very excited because we're just a month away from season 4, the final season, right? I don't know what season it is, of Lock and Key, which was also shot in Toronto. So Carolyn, hey, thinking of you. Excuse me. Thank you, Badreddine, for your kind words. We so appreciate it. And now I have a tickle. Excuse me. What do you think of my mugs? I threw this mug on my own. Can you tell? It's imperfectly imperfect. excuse me. Oh my goodness, got that tickle going on. Okay, so please feel free, write in today with your questions. Let's get as specific as possible. Let's remember that we have lots of experts that come on the show. I'm not one of them. I'm not an expert in autism. Let's be real, real clear about that. I'm a parent who's been in this, in it to win it, right? From minute one, when my son was diagnosed at 2.5, that makes it sound like I was like, oh, I got this. I did not. I still don't have it. That's why we work together, right? Si se puede, we hold hands. We do this together. But I've learned a thing or two from interviewing experts and watching my son go through this. My son was diagnosed, I can't even do the math. He was 2.5 and now he's 19. Somebody do the math. And even before the 11 years of doing this show, I spent several years hosting a radio show called Everyday Autism Miracles, where I was interviewing experts. So I have learned a thing or two. I've picked up on a couple of things. I've gotten some clarity about things that I like to share from time to time. It's why I wrote a book called Autism Parent to Parent. And we really felt like on the show, we wanted to be covering some of those topics this summer. That are kicking your can, just to hear it from another parent who's lived through it, survived it, watched a bunch of parents survive it, and talked to a bunch of experts about it. There's the book. We don't mean to be stuffing the book down your throat, but if you want it, it's there. It's available. I didn't used to be able to say to you, here's a place where you can go and hear all the things that I have going on in my head after all this time. And now there is. So, but you can also be here, and here is free. We like that. Okay. So let's jump in here. So not an expert, but somebody who really cares and wants to help you get to the help that you need. And sometimes you just need that best friend, right? The best friend, the girlfriend's guide to whatever, right? The best friend who has your best interest at heart and is going to give you the skinny, and they're not going to candy coat it for you. They're going to say, this is going to be hard. This sucks, but you know what? You can totally do this, and don't listen to this person when they tell you this, right? That's all I want to do. Gaurav, hi from India. My son doesn't listen to me, doesn't follow any instructions. What do I do? Okay, well, that's the whole conversation about compliance. And hopefully by the end of the hour, we'll have given you some tips that will help you with that. But that's a whole other discussion. And today we're going to talk about stimming. But I will tell you that that's compliance. And compliance is super easy when we give them a reason to participate. Traven says we should do that one next. All right. So next one of these shows will hit compliance. How about if I promise you that? But let me say that it's not hard to get compliance as long as you're thinking along the lines of what do they want? How can I make it worth them to be compliant? Our kids want to be compliant. And for those of you who are already freaking out going, well, I don't want a compliant child because compliant child can be hurt by people. This is what I like about ABA because ABA teaches kids how to decide whether you want to do something or not. And whether it's in your best interest. So teaching compliance in the way that ABA teaches, if you're doing good ABA, teaches it actually makes kids who are decision makers. And they decide, I want to be compliant with mom because that's when all the good things happen. And I don't want to be compliant with this scary individual because there's nothing in it for me. So I super love that. It's not about them being mindless compliant. It's about them being mindful compliant, which means we got to make it worth their while. So if you know, I love Dr. Grampuche, and Dr. Grampuche says, if I asked you to go to work and I told you, I don't know when you're going to get paid and I don't know when it's going to be over and I don't know what's in it for you. I mean, we see this is what has happened. People stop going to work, right? They just don't come. And this is our kids. What's in it for me is basically what he's saying. You know, years ago, when people say that ABA is dog training, it isn't. Because dog training is dog training, but ABA is a teaching tool. And yes, they use it with dogs and bears and people and factory workers and, you know, older people and younger people. And because it's a teaching tool, right? It works. And the first time I took my dog to dog training and there was the guy standing next to me and we were all supposed to take our dogs, set them over someplace and then say, come here. As a place to see, like how much to use. And then they would put us in different groups for where to start. And the one guy who was standing next to me just stood there and yelled at his dog and said, get over here right now. And the dog wouldn't come because you know what? The dog wasn't stupid. Why would you walk towards someone who was yelling at you? Yeah. And sometimes, you know, hopefully we don't do that with our kids, but you know, we say, come here. And we forget about the fact that your child is going, what's in it for me? And we really have to be thinking about that always with compliance. So that's my hint about that. Christina says, need ideas to help regulate. We're working on sensory diet. Okay. Well, that's today's talk about stimming is going to help with that. So I don't know why that isn't working, Trayvon, but this one is. So I'm not going to care about that. We're not attending to that. In any case, so let's jump right in with our jargon of the day. And Carolyn, I see your question, but I haven't read it yet. But I see that it's there. So jargon of the day, this is when we take on one word, one phrase, one acronym. We try to figure out what are the experts talking about? What does this have to do with us? Usually we give you the actual definition whenever possible. I poke fun of it, you know, because it's my hobby. And then we move on to a working definition that hopefully gives us a better idea, sometimes not as much, but gives us a better idea about what are we talking about? And what does it mean to us? So today, our entire topic today that we're going to be talking about is stimming. So let's take a look at what the actual definition of stimming is. And I don't even know which one we have. Oh, stimming, a self-stimulatory behavior that is marked by a repetitive action or movement of the body, such as repeating tapping on objects or the ears, snapping the fingers, blinking the eyes, rocking from side to side, or grunting, and is typically associated with certain conditions such as autism spectrum disorder. And we told you where this definition came from because it's from Merriam-Webster, and I want to shove it into the ocean for a lot of different reasons. I want to shove this into the ocean. It's not hard to understand, but it really is not helpful or elucidating, and it's off in the wrong cornfield as far as I'm concerned. We're going to start from this point and then we're going to work backwards. Let's take a look at what our actual definition is and see if we can't make heads or tails of this. And then I might go back to why I hate that other definition. Stimming is a coping strategy that should not be stigmatized. Okay. This is the definition that we have to start from. Because if we can go back, I don't know how hard it is to go back, Trayvon. One of the things that I hate about this is that we use the term stimming, and stimming came from self-stimulatory behavior, but it is what they call a misnomer. That now when people refer to stimming, they're referring to a class of behaviors that's much bigger than self-stimulatory. Sometimes people are doing the behavior to self-soothe. And I don't know about you, but when the first time, you know, I was around people and they kept saying, well, I would be like, why is he doing that? I don't understand that behavior. Why is he doing that? And they would go, oh, it's just a stim. And I went, well, what's a stim? And then they were like, well, it's a self-stimulatory behavior. And I thought, but that's not stimulating him. So I just didn't understand it. And I didn't put a lot of faith into it. But it's one of those terms that's just been overused. But we're going to continue to talk about it because this is how people talk about it now. But just know that it doesn't just mean self-stimulatory. It means also self-soothing. And the other thing that I hate about this is that it says that it's typically associated with certain conditions. This is a lie. This is an absolute bald-faced lie. People notice when individuals who are on the spectrum stim, because sometimes their stims are different looking than for people who don't have autism. But guess what? We all stim. The person at Merriam-Webster who wrote this definition stims. And I don't know whether they're on the spectrum or not, but I know that they stim. So this makes me hot under the collar. And if we go back to our working definition, it's super important to me that we all start being on the same page and saying that this is a coping strategy for the individual, which automatically implies that it has a reason. It, you know, in the parlance of the experts, it has a function. It has a place. It's doing something. It is not random. It is not weird. It is not odd. And when we put words like weird, random, odd on it, we stigmatize it. Now, you guys write in about stimming for a bunch of different reasons, but we're going to start to separate out what those reasons are and how we approach it based on the reason for you. But we're never going to lose sight of that there is a reason for the individual. It is a coping strategy that should not be stigmatized. We're going to build on this as we talk about how and when we work on behaviors that are that we term stimming. But again, remembering it's not all self-stimulatory. Okay, so my question of the day for all of you as we kick this off is a simple question. Now that you know that absolutely everybody stims, my question for you is, how do you stim? What do you do? And, you know, this is going to, for some of you, it's going to hurt your brain a little bit because you're going to go, well, I don't do that. But go back to the definition, coping mechanism. How do you cope? What do you do? And because usually when we're talking about stimming, we're talking about repetitive and sometimes restrictive behaviors. So again, how do you stim? And I stim in so many different ways. Like what I just did, I play with my ring. That's a stim. That is me seeking sensory information because I need to do something with my hands. And gesturing in a way is a stim, right? So once you start to look at it and go, oh, if I remove all the negative stigmatization of this and said, okay, what kinds of things do I do repeatedly to cope? My mom used to do this thing where she would take her middle finger and she would like take her hand like this and just rub whatever it was. So she'd be sitting on upholstery and she would just be doing this. And that was a thing that she would do. But my mother also crocheted and knitted. And it was the thing because her hands had to be in constant motion. She couldn't just read a book. I just was reading a post about my mother last night. You know how those memories come up on Facebook. And I was reading this post about her that's very true. My mother could not, she loved to read, never went anywhere without her book and never went anywhere without a knitting or a crochet project to be with her. And she could not just sit and read her book. If she did, she'd go to sleep and just pass out, go to sleep. But if she sat and read and would be knitting at the same time and usually drinking her coffee, three things, or watching TV, four things, then she was very productive. She could read the book, watch the movie, drink her coffee, and knit you a sweater all at the same time. And that is how she self-regulated. And if you took her knitting away, she was less comfortable and she would end up doing this. Should we stigmatize that? No, I don't think so. Carolyn says, I'm neurotypical and I shake my foot or whistle all the time. God bless you, Carolyn. And thank you for writing that in because we all do something. So how do you stim? Let's own it. Let's own it, because if we're coming from a place of understanding that we stim, then looking at how the people that we love in our lives stim is going to be coming from a different place. And that's the place that we want it to come from, right? Okay, so, and I see people writing things and we're going to get to this in just a second. But now let's move on to our topic of the week that we're going to be talking about this week. And I love this because it's what we should be talking about every week. It kind of is what we're talking about every week, but empowering those on the spectrum. Let's always be doing that. When I said earlier that our mission here, see, I'm going to well up. I said I wasn't going to cry, but I'm going to. Our mission here is to provide information and inspiration. And our audience for that is that larger autism community, which we always say starts with individuals who are on the spectrum, of course. And if you haven't checked out our new show, Stories from the Spectrum, which is all just created by and for those on the spectrum who consider themselves neurodiverse, you should be checking that out. I think it's a great show. I'm loving it. And I'm loving seeing what these individuals create for us. And we largely stay all the way out of it. We just put them on a timeline. So that's all we're doing to put it together, right? And we're commissioning people to do work. So if you're somebody who's an artist on the spectrum and want to be a part of that, please reach out to me. Yeah. My email is shannon@autism-live.com. These folks are being paid. It's not an incredible amount of money, but they're getting paid for the work that they do. So check that out, Stories from the Spectrum. But I got to tell you, you know, as we talk on this show, we say we start with the individuals who are on the spectrum, of course, but we include everyone who loves them in our conversation. So if you care about somebody who's on the autism spectrum, welcome home. You're a part of our tribe and we want you to be here. And if we are good allies, then we will empower those on the spectrum. It's that whole thing about if you give a man a fish, you fed him for the day, but if you teach him how to fish, then you fed him for a lifetime. And we don't want to just, I don't anyway, and the people that work here, we don't want to just stop at, not that it's not a good thing, but we don't want to stop at giving opportunities to folks who are on the spectrum. We also want to empower them to be able to do all the things that they want to do. Yeah. Okay. So that's really, and as we talk about stimming, it's got to come from that place. And if it's not coming from that place, we need to back up three steps and go, what's really happening here? So here are some important things to remember. I already told you the first one, everybody stims. It's like we all need to do that. In fact, I'm going to drop in for a second and just look at some of the comments. Somebody says, I crochet and knit and play with my hair. I run my palms soft. I rub my palms softly often. Yep, we all do that. Somebody says, I'm a 42-year-old high-functioning autistic woman and I stem by pacing back and forth and flick my fingers and also do things like listening to the same song or album over and over. Oh, absolutely, right? I'm also looking at some other things here. Okay. Need ideas to help regulate sensory diet. We did that one. Possibly a strange question. My 11-year-old stims mainly with vocals. When he's relaxed and at peace, I hear particular repetitive sounds. When he starts meds for focus and it's a low dose and they work, noticeably at school anyways, when he's on his meds, I don't hear those sounds, not see him stimming. He's happy when he stims, so has his meds plateaued, is happy. It's a great question. I don't think that that's a bad question at all. And I think it's a question worth investigating. Right? Because, you know, for anybody who has been on any kind of meds, it affects you and we don't want to be taking away the happy. So I think that that's a question worth investigating. I would be taking notes. I don't know if your child is at an age where you can ask. Sometimes you want to be careful because you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, right? My son was a vocal stimmer. They call it vocal stereotypy, if you want to Google. And he would make these little noises. He sounded like R2-D2 and very high-pitched. I can't even make the noise, but he'd go, you know, just like R2-D2. So if he liked something, you would hear that, but much higher, like pitch that an octave or two higher. And, you know, it was sometimes, depending on what was going on, there were different noises, right? But in order to focus, he was making that noise and we didn't think that it was a problem at all, right? And this is one of the things we're about to talk about is when do you target a behavior? When do you say that this is a challenging behavior and it has to be addressed? And when he was home and playing, it had no bearing on his life. It wasn't preventing him from doing anything. So we weren't targeting. Then he went off to kindergarten and the kids in the class all started saying that he was weird. And that we were like, well, let's educate those kids, right? And the kindergarten teacher was working on that. But then there was also the thing that it was preventing other kids from focusing on their work. Because sometimes the noises were so continuous and so much, it was hard for the other kids to focus. So they were asking not to sit next to him. Now we got a problem, right? But we don't want to take away his coping mechanism, but we need to be able to make it work within his life. So what happened was his ABA team sat down with him. They looked at how and when he was doing it. And they determined that it was possible that he could internalize it, that he was at a time and an age where that was a possibility. And it took us a while. And so what it did, what it helped him with perspective taking, and it empowered him, literally our topic for today, it empowered him so that he had a choice of, did he want to make the noise out loud or make the noise inside? We were also at the same time working about on the fact that sometimes you have thoughts that you don't share, right? Because there was the trip to the grocery store where we were behind the man who had an amazingly large nose. Like, I am talking call the news large noise nose. And my son was like, Mom, look at that man's nose. And I was like, no. You know, and he was like, but that man's nose. And I was like, don't do it. And then we went out to the parking lot and we talked about how sometimes you have thoughts and they're valid thoughts, but we don't always speak our thoughts out loud because it might hurt somebody else's feelings, right? So we were working on that all at the same time. And they taught him how to be able to make the noise inside his head. It took a while. And I was sad because then I didn't hear the noises and it was a way that I could gauge how happy he was. But the truth was he still had it still functioned for him the same way. Now, it is not the same for all people. Some people, it is the vagus nerve gets stimulated and there is a calming thing. Like I was taught, I have a heart arrhythmia and I was taught to hum when the arrhythmia comes, because it helps. There's literally a physiological thing that happens. Your vagus nerve is there and it calms some of the things. So this may not be the thing that works for your child, but it could be something to look at. And it might be that the meds are not the right meds. It's a distinct possibility. But if we're looking at this always through the lens of empowering him, you're going to find the right answer at some point. Where am I here? Son just started flapping stim. Usually it's just vocal stim, repeating things he hears. And someone else says, I ask because even when we are late one random day for getting his meds, I can hear his happy stims coming from his room while playing. I would talk to the doctor about that, about, you know, and if you can talk to your child about it. My son pretends that he is being chased by dinos and he runs around in circles from our living room through the kitchen. This can last 10 to 20 minutes. He also repeats and repeats and repeats until you answer him 100 times. Could these tasks he does be stimming? Well, I definitely, yeah. I mean, the whole thing with stimming is that it's a coping mechanism. And it's usually an inside job is what, how they determine it, that it's something that the reinforcer that they're getting for it, the paycheck that they're getting for it is something inside them. So when you hum, you know, and you get that vagus nerve going, it's all on the inside. Other people can't really see the paycheck that you're getting. And so that's what we find with those self-stimulatory behaviors is that they actually all come under the heading of automatic reinforced behavior. There's another thing if you want to Google, just find all the strategies for this automatic reinforced behavior. Means that it's inside. The reinforcer is not candy that they're getting. It's not, you know, somebody laughing or smiling. The paycheck is almost always for these kinds of behaviors on the inside, which makes it harder because it's harder to see, it's harder to know, which means it's harder to pin down what's the actual thing that they're getting for it. Because here's the thing with these behaviors. If it's something that's actually helping them to cope, we never want to take away a coping mechanism without putting something else that works the same or better. I'm going to say that again, maybe twice. If it's a coping mechanism, and we've said that stimming behaviors are coping mechanisms, we never want to take it away unless we have put something in its place that works as good or better. Because if we're about empowering the individual, we wouldn't do anything else. Does that make sense? Carolyn says, wow, these are really interesting points that I'd never looked at this way. It may be he is focusing sound and I hear it when he's passionate and happy and what he's doing, when in turn is when he himself is super focused. I will definitely ask him, but thanks for giving me insight to know exactly what I'm asking. There you go. And he may not even be aware of it. You think about how long you've done a stim before you noticed you were doing it. And sometimes it was when somebody else pointed it out to you, right? That you're doing something. So we have a lot of people watching and they or the person that they love could be anywhere from one to 101, right? And it's all different. The reasons why we engage in the STEM and the thing that we do are all different. So that it's hard to give just like a carte blanche on anything, but let's talk about some real specifics here. So when, if you've looked at a behavior and you've said, okay, this behavior, I think we should change. I want you to back up for just a second and ask yourself some really important questions. And the first one is why? Why do you have the feeling that this behavior should change? And I want you to be accepting of yourself as a person while you ask the question, because sometimes we want to change the behavior for us. And that doesn't make you a bad person. I just want you to notice it if it is your agenda or their agenda. Because if it's your agenda, we're going to work on it in a different way that may not involve the child. I had a friend who had a daughter who was not on the spectrum, but she was beautiful in an interesting way. And in a way that was so shocking and stunning that often other children and even adults looked at her and said she looked weird. I don't understand why people are like that, but if they don't understand something, they have to label it and they call something weird, right? There was nothing weird about this child, nothing odd about this child, except the fact that she was just strikingly different facial features that are beautiful. But people were calling it odd and weird. And I offer you this example to show you how meaningless it is when people say something is weird or odd. What they're really saying, if we could translate, is, I don't understand that. Which that has to do with them, not with the individual that they're calling weird or odd. Now, that's the truth. But it doesn't take into account what it feels like. And this, when kids would call this little girl weird or odd, the mother would die. She just like didn't know what to do, because and the little girl would hear this and she would cry and go, why do people always say this about me? And how do you explain to a four-year-old, because you're gorgeous and people don't know how to handle that? So mom would die inside, dad would get angry. And I was with them sometimes when he would go up to kids and go, what's your problem? What's wrong with you? Right? Why are you? And I think we can all understand the anger about, why would you make my child feel bad for something that she has no control over? And in this case, it was being stunningly beautiful in a way you've never seen before. Right? But with our kids, we, you know, when our kids do something and we think they're going to be ostracized or they're going to be made fun of, we don't like it. And I'm not saying get over it. I'm saying acknowledge that. Acknowledge that that's what's going on, because then you can cope with that in various and different ways and come to the issue with your child in a different place that's about empowering them, not about changing them because you're uncomfortable because somebody's an idiot. Do you see what I'm saying? So, you know, I would also tell you that in the field of ABA, there are some amazing, amazing people in the field of ABA. And I'm talking about all kinds of therapy too, whatever it is that you're talking about, whether it's ABA or speech or OT or you're doing Sunrise or whatever. There's, you know, look, these people got into this field because they want to help and they want to support. But sometimes information filters down in a certain way and they're dealing with the same feelings that you're dealing with. And I would just caution you that you also want to make sure that your team is on this page as well. So let me not get too far off my schedule. So before you target the behavior, you got to ask yourself, why do I want this behavior to change? And is it absolutely necessary? Because when you have a child or a teen or an adult on the autism spectrum, we want to be as mindful as possible when working on behaviors. And there are a lot of behaviors because we want them to maximize their learning. We want them to be able to, if they're having a deficit with being able to communicate, it doesn't mean that they don't have something to communicate. They're just having trouble communicating with the other people in their life. We want to help set them up for success so that they can get their needs met, right? There's a lot of things to be worked on. So a lot of times though, the first thing that parents will say is, and I was one of them, you know, can we work on that behavior? Because that's what seems to be the problem. And we miss the big picture. So I always want you to look at it and go, why do I want that behavior to change? And is it necessary? Because if it, the thing about my son making the noises, it wasn't necessary. Not when he was at home doing therapy, just wasn't necessary. Wasn't bothering him, wasn't bothering anybody else, wasn't preventing him from being able to do the things that were important to him. It wasn't preventing him from learning. So we would not target that behavior at that time. When it was preventing him from having social situations and things like that, we targeted it. Now, sometimes you'll run a behavior and you go to your ABA provider and they go, all right, well, we're going to target this. And it's perfectly acceptable for you to say, talk to me about that. Why do you want to target that? Because I don't think it's a problem right now. And often what they will tell you is it's not a problem right now, but in 6 months when they go to first grade, it's going to be a problem. Please listen to them when they say that, but please don't accept everything carte blanche and be like, okay, they said to target it without knowing why. You are a part of the team. You can ask them why. Why do you want to target that now? And if you find that they're getting defensive about that, don't just immediately dismiss them. But say, hey, I know you're somebody who knows and you don't just do things randomly. So help me to understand why, because I want you to be building a relationship with the people that you're working with that's based in empowering your child. And if they really don't want to talk to you about ways to empower your child, then you know you're with the wrong provider. Does that make sense? I hope so. I need to look and see the other things. Do stims evolve like Entress? So like he used to do a spinning thing all the time, and now he's more into like hand flapping and repeating things that he's seen or heard. And hi, Michelle, saying hi to you. Yeah, stims absolutely evolve. If you think about yourself, like, do you have a stim that you remember doing as a child that you don't do now? I used to do this thing where I would rub my nose like this endlessly. And my mother took me to the doctor. She was like, you know, she's going to break the cartilage. She's going to have the weirdest looking nose. And actually my nose used to tilt up more than it does now, but I would just rub it constantly. And the doctor was brilliant. And he said, I think she has allergies. I think she's rubbing her nose because her nose itches. And then later I had a nephew did the same thing. And instead of, you know, going, stop rubbing your nose, we took him to the allergist. You know, sometimes you gotta like look for why is this happening, but I don't do this endlessly anymore. Of course, when my nose itches, but I don't do it 8 hours a day. So you do things to soothe yourself, to cope in the moment, and what you need to do to cope changes, which is part of the reason why we know that stims can change, that we can empower somebody by giving them what they need, but giving it in a more productive way. So we can get excited about that, knowing that it can change. Okay. But we're not ever just going, let's take it away. You just can't do that anymore. Nicholas says, I noticed in my kid years, now becoming an adult, when I was a kid, I was stimming. I keep repeating and repeating myself. But as I felt very hyper as a child. Yeah. I mean, you know, I think with awareness, as we grow older and we become more aware, and sometimes you become aware when you're in a relationship with somebody who goes, why are you doing that? You know, and you go, oh, I don't know why I'm doing that. Is it bothering you? And then, you know, we morph and change because of that. We don't have an expectation that a four-year-old is going to care about what you think about what they do. It's just not going to be important to them. They're at a different point in their development. That's going to come a little bit later, right? But stimming can morph and change because remember, it's a coping mechanism. And have you ever had the experience? I certainly have, where you did something to cope with something and it got you through enough that you kept doing it and doing it over and over again. And then you met somebody who said, oh, you know, what's really good for that is this. And it's so much easier and it's so much better. And you go, oh, I'm going to do that from now on, right? I don't have to do that other thing. I'm somebody who has OCD. And I used to be somebody that would get into little patterns where I would have to go back and check the door 5 times, right? That's its own little ring of hell, right? And then I worked with a cognitive behavioral therapist who taught me a better way. So I don't have to go back and check the door 5 times. They did not change who I was. They did not rip something away from me. They acknowledged that it was helping me to cope and gave me a different way of coping, plus a way of identifying what was going on for me. So I just want to be clear that for those of you who are on the spectrum and are watching, I think that if we, somebody wrote to us the other day and said, we've done a little segment about stimming and about finding the reason for the stim. And they said, please don't look for the reason. We need this. And if you look for the reason, you're going to take it away from us. And I hear that. And I want to say to you, I want to be part of the empowering where nobody's taking anything away from you, where we give people choices. And sometimes, and if we're doing it right, we give them a choice that's more functional than the old way. That for the child that somebody wrote in and said they run around the house for 10 minutes, just repeating the same thing over and over and over again, I offer up to you Temple Grandin. That Temple says that, you know, she has a certain amount of energy that she has that she, if she doesn't expend it, then she has anxiety. And so she has learned over the years that at a certain time every night, she has to do a short burst of intense physical exertion that she can do, whether she's in a hotel or at home, that she just does like a short burst of calisthenics that gives her a release of whatever the pent up thing is that she has going on, releases endorphins, whatever. And it used to be that she had to do it for hours. Because I asked her once, I said, do you still use the cow squisher? And she said, no, I've learned a better way is for me to just, you know, do a short burst, like 2 minutes of calisthenics. It releases those chemicals and then allows me to relax. And I don't have to go through the anxiety of that I would have to go through otherwise. So I offer that up to you, that your child running around for 10 to 15 minutes might be that kind of a thing where they've got to expend a certain amount of energy. And I know some of you who are watching, I'm seeing what you've written in. So that expense of energy might be a way of regulating them. So other people that are listening have trampolines for their kids or something, or they do an exercise with them and say, okay, now is when we're going to the park and you're going to run around the track 4 times and then we go home. And if they're repeating things while they're running around the track, let them, depending on what it is, or start teaching them how do you say it softer and softer until you're saying it in your head. Okay. Okay. Let's talk for a second about when kids are saying things that are not appropriate, because that may or may not be a self-stimulatory behavior. Remember that we said that stimming the paycheck is on the inside, but sometimes kids do things, and the usual culprit for saying things that are incendiary is attention. And listen, our kids are innocent. They don't know what they're saying, right? But our kids are smart and they pick up on things. And if somebody says something or uses a phrase and everybody goes, you know, because it's an inappropriate thing, kids file that and go, that's something. It's an electric response. It's good television. It's like, that's something. And now I have everyone's attention and people are looking at me and everyone needs a certain amount of attention. And the dial is set differently on all people, right? It's hard because your child learns, oh, if I say this, then people will react. And you might stop reacting, but you go to a grocery store and you can't control the responses of everybody around you. So there are techniques that can be used to change behaviors like that. And one of them is when you heavily reinforce a behavior that conflicts. So if you're going to the grocery store, for instance, and you know that there's a phrase that your child says that is inappropriate, then we work on a song or something that is appropriate. And we say, we're going to go into the grocery store and you and I very softly are going to sing this song the whole grocery store. And if by the time we leave the grocery store, we have sung the whole time and didn't do anything else but singing the song, and you can do this with a million things. It doesn't have to be a song. I'm just giving an example. If we go through the entire grocery store and all we do is sing the song and we don't say anything else, both of us, then I'm going to give you the treat that I know that you want, the big treat, right? So what we're doing is we're reinforcing a behavior that if they're singing, they can't be saying whatever the other phrase is, right? You can do this, like if the child is picking their nose, you can give them a ball and say, I'm going to ask you to hold the ball for a certain period of time. And then you're going to give me the ball back. And if you've held the ball the whole time, then you get the reinforcer. So it's basically a competing behavior that we give them so they can't do the behavior, so they're not getting the attention for it, and we starve the attention that way, right? It's called being super duper clever. The other thing that we can do, depending on the age and the understanding of the child, is that we can have a frank conversation and say, you're saying this and this is inappropriate. So I'm going to make it worth your while to not say that. So we're going to go into the store. You can talk about absolutely anything. You can sing if you want to. You can say whatever you want, but you can't say this. And if we leave the store and you haven't said that, then you're going to get this reward. And in the meantime, if we know that it's attention, we're going to shower them attention as long as they're not saying the phrase. And if we put in a consequence strategy so that if they say the phrase that is not the phrase that we want to hear, we immediately leave the store. There is no treat, and if it's attention that they're getting from it, you quietly, if you have to pick them up and take them to the car, and then there is no attention for it. There's no lecture. You sit in silence in the car. You get them in their harness and you drive home. You're not ignoring your child. You're there with your child. You're not ignoring them, but there is no attention. So you've put them in their harness. You did whatever. You don't berate them. You just drive home in silence. You don't put the radio on. Kids get it. And they quickly learn, my life is better if I do the things that, that goes back to that compliance conversation. So I don't think that particular thing is a stim. It's possible. Sudi have not been around, had a lot of things to deal with right now, including Boris lost his job, partner of 15 years lied to me. Oh, I'm sorry, but you say LOL. But having autism, when I found out, gave me Tourette's. I wake up with swearing after memories. It's the only way I can live through this situation. Can I ask if anyone has had Tourette's, or did the spectrum include PTSD? And Tourette's is a separate thing. And Tourette's doesn't even come under the heading of self-stimulatory or automatic reinforcing. Tourette's is an entirely different thing, but I will tell you that they've had great success with dietary control of Tourette's. Look that up and see what you can find. But yes, and it is interesting that when somebody has Tourette's, the things that they say are inappropriate. So if you feel that it's not attention seeking and somebody is saying something inappropriate, ask somebody if this could be Tourette's, right? Okay. So let me get back to what I was talking about. Okay. So we want to be asking ourselves, when somebody is stimming, why are they stimming? Is it something we want to work on? And then we want to try to figure out what the function is. And if we feel that it's something on the inside, that there is, that it is fulfilling a need, we want to tread very carefully to empower them. And again, we're never going to take away a coping mechanism without replacing it with something that works better. For instance, a lot of our kids do this thing at a certain age where they crash into other children. They just run up and crash into them on the playground or whatever. And kids don't like that. They're like, I don't, want to deal with that. So we figure out and we look at it and go, why, what do we think that they're doing? But a lot of times kids are doing something because it feels good, because it gives attention, and because they don't have another way of communicating. So in the case of crashing into other children, we would want to give them a different way of coping with being around kids and not knowing how to communicate with them. So we would want to teach them a phrase or a sign or something to walk up to other children without touching them that connects us communication-wise. Like it could be walking up and waving, right? That's a way to say hello to someone. It could be walking up and signing. It could be walking up and holding up your iPad and pushing the button that says want to play. And once kids are taught these things as a way of connecting with other kids, then those behaviors of crashing stop. Same thing with the stimming behavior that, for instance, somebody brought up hand flapping. I don't know if you've ever hand flapped, but I'm going to say to you that as long as it's not something that's hurting them, if your child is engaging in a stim, I want to encourage you in the privacy of your own home when your child isn't watching, do it yourself. Do the stim that they're doing, whatever it is, and see, like, you know, and if you're by yourself, right? Because not the things that are attention seeking. Because if you're by yourself, it's going to get boring, right? But when my child hand flapped, I said, I'm going to try it. I'm going to see what this is. Now, what you get from it may not be what your child gets. And you have to be mindful of that. But you will see that there is something to be gained by hand flapping. For me, that is like an automatic anxiety release, flapping my hands. Plus which, I see colors when I hand flap. If I was bored and anxious, I would do this. You betcha. Why wouldn't I? I have a friend who wrote in and said, my boyfriend hand flaps like this when he's happy, that's his way of expressing, and he's an adult. That's his way of expressing that he's happy. Different, right? Very, very different things. But once we start to look at why are they doing it, why do I think they're doing it, we have to make room for the fact that what we think may not be the thing, then we want to ask ourselves a couple of questions. Is it preventing them from being able to do the things that they want? Temple used to like to spin a metal plate on her bed. And in talking to her, and she also liked to pick up sand and have it go between her fingers. And she says, left to her own devices, she could still do that for hours. And I've talked to her about what is it? And she says, oh my gosh, it's so pleasurable because if you change the rate that the sand is going or the change the rate that the plate is moving, that the lights and the color and the way light hits it move at a different rate. It's just like so fulfilling. That it's deeply, deeply pleasurable. And when you hear her talk about how deeply, deeply pleasurable it is, I don't know about you, but my heart goes, I don't want to take that away from her, right? Why would I want to take that away from her? And if you talk to her mother, Eustacia, she said, I didn't want to take it away from her, but I also didn't want her to be somebody that's all she ever did was spin the plate on the bed, because I saw in her that she had other things that she liked to do as well too. So she would push her and say, in this case, she decided that she put limits on it and said, you can spin the plate on your bed 1 hour a day. And she scheduled it and put it on a visual planner and said, this is the hour that Temple gets to spin the thing. And Temple was like, oh, I know I get to do it then. I know I get to do my favorite thing. And then she made her go do other things like learn how to draw horses. And she also had to muck the stalls for the horses. And she worked with animals and look, she's had this brilliant career drawing, you know, plans and working with animals. And, you know, she still likes to engage in those behaviors. She didn't change who she was. She didn't take away the coping mechanism. She limited it and said, here's when it's appropriate. Here's, you know, and let her know on a schedule, you're going to get to do it. So she didn't have to feel anxious. Like, when am I going to get to do that again? Do you have an app on your phone that you play compulsively? Do you do Wordle? Like, you know, I look forward every morning to doing Wordle. Every morning I look forward to doing Wordle. And if somebody said to me, that's it, I'm yanking it away from you because, you know, you have too many other things to do, I would have a hard time with that. I'm not saying I'd have a meltdown, because I would just go, no, right? But if somebody had the capability of taking that away from me, and taking away others of my rights, I would have a hard time and it would be taking away a right. But I'm capable of saying to myself, well, I do Wordle. It's once a time in the morning and I don't do Wordle all day, but I look forward to it every day. And your kiddo or teen or adult might look forward to it too. So when we do something like that, where we limit it, we want to make sure that the other things that they're going to in the beginning are super reinforcing. Eustacia Cutler knew that Temple liked being around the horses. So she said, go draw the horses, go muck the stalls and draw the horses and be around the horses. She didn't say, go do the dishes. Right? There is a time and a place for that, teaching kids how to do chores when they don't want to do them, right? Because we all need to learn that too. But it's important that when we're working on not having them do the self-stimulatory behavior over and over and over again ad infinitum, because it's preventing them from doing other learning, that we make sure that they know that they're going to get an opportunity to do it. And we give them strict guidelines about it's okay to do it at this time. It's okay to do it in this place. This is when it's okay to do it. And we reinforce that for them, give them rewards for doing it in the place and the time in which they are, it's appropriate. At a certain point, we did say to my son, at school, you make the noises in your head. At home, you can make them out loud. In your own room, make whatever noise you want to do, right? So that we gave him appropriate limits for it. We didn't just take it away. We've talked a little bit about morphing the behavior so that it does something else. I love when, one of the stims that we see kids do that's a real problem. The people go, oh, okay, we can't have this. They spit on their hands and then they play in the spit on their desk or, you know, on their face or on their leg or whatever. And especially, you know, this was always a problem, this behavior. And then COVID came and that can prevent you from being able to go to school. Talk about limiting your life. But we cannot just negate that there is a need. If they're doing it, there's a need for doing it. So they spit on their hands and they rub their hands. Now, for some of the kids, this is about the tactile feeling of the wet against a surface. For other kids, it's about making the colors on the desk because spit is shiny, right? So if it's the kiddo that it's about the feel of it, we've had great success with getting these little pillows that are called silkies. Sometimes they're pillows, sometimes they have a vibrator inside, and sometimes it's just a piece of fabric. Right? Like almost like a silk hanky, but some of them have fur and they're called silkies, little piece of fur, and the kids can take them out and pet them. And what it does is it helps them to self-regulate, but there's no spit. And the teachers allow them to take their silky out and play with it whenever. Now, when it's time to do handwriting, we have to take the silky and put it away for a period. But when handwriting is over, you can have time again. So we're using two things. We're putting a replacement in there, and then eventually we're limiting the replacement so that it doesn't get in the way of learning another skill, right? We're not stigmatizing it. We're not saying it's wrong. We're saying you're doing this because you need to do this. Let's give you a way to do it that doesn't prevent you from doing all the other things that you want to do. Okay. I've got some other questions here. I think Tourette's should be on the spectrum because it's a meltdown equivalent and it's the same as someone shouting out for help with autism. Same as shouting on a cliff. Why me? And you also said COVID killed life and changed normality. It definitely did that. Now, like all things, nothing is ever completely one thing or the other, right? And I think that there is quite a bit of overlap with autism and Tourette's, but there are people who have Tourette's who don't have autism, and there are people who have autism who don't have Tourette's. I don't know whether they're considering it being part of the autism spectrum, to be honest with you, but I do think that there are elements of the Tourette's and the way it reacts with the brain that are very interesting. And What's telling for me, Gareth, is that I have not seen, and believe me, I don't know everything, but I have not seen a lot of behavioral intervention working on Tourette's, but I have seen people have great success with diet, with Tourette's, which tells me that that is more of a biochemical thing. And we see a lot of that in autism, right? But it needs to be targeted in a different way that's mindful, because when you do a behavioral intervention for something that is biochemical, it's frustrating and you're not going to have as much success. And as for COVID, you know, do I wish that COVID had not happened. And I, like a lot of you, mourn some of the things that have happened with COVID, but I'm somebody who's got to see the glass half empty. And I always want to look and go, okay, but what happened? What did we learn from it? What happened as a result? What will make us stronger, better in the future? How can we utilize, how can we make the most of? It isn't always possible. It isn't always possible. And there was a whole bag of you poo that came with COVID. But I'm hoping that we will learn the lessons that we need to learn and that life will move forward. Okay, I got a couple more things and we're like out of time. Okay, so we talked a little bit about what are some ways that we can replace a behavior. I want you to all start to be detectives and think, okay, if what this is doing, and think about the senses when you think about a self-stimulatory behavior, what sense is being regulated, soothed, ignited, what, like, because if somebody is doing something that involves touch, it's possible that there is a tactile response that they are needing to help them to stay focused, right? And then we would replace tactile with tactile. And you start asking yourself, well, what would be, you know, more appropriate? We talked last week about the amazing, you know, a new study about drumming, that drumming is very helpful for individuals who are on the autism spectrum. When we talked about Logan Shepherd, that he was doing hand flapping and his parents felt that it was a motion thing, not a color thing. And so they put drumsticks in his hand, which is almost the same, you know, look at the motions. They're very similar. And the kid is a professional drummer. Okay. So you start to think, okay, what is it that they're getting? It could be that they're getting visual input from it. That, you know, we talked about our friend that likes to splash water, and that we've determined that it's seeing the colors, that he likes to see the colors. Well, splashing water is fine, but if you're going to do that 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you're not going to get other things done. So they taught him how to wash dishes, and he, there is never a dirty dish in their house, because he's like, oh, let me wash the dish, because he gets that reinforcer, but it's a very functional thing. But they also taught him how to paint, and he's a brilliant painter. And he cleans his brushes. He gets it when he puts his stuff on the canvas. It's all functional for him and makes him deeply happy. Does he still like to get in the pool and splash? Yes, but he can go and paint paintings and do the dishes. He's getting his needs met and being who he is, right? So we get creative with how do we replace a behavior? How do we put limitations on it? We've already talked about that a little bit, that we have to be clear with them about this is the time and the place, this is how much time you get, and then we need to stick to that. Yes, Gareth, using compassion and care and love and understanding. What are the ethical guidelines to working on these kinds of behaviors? I go back to my original statement. If you say to yourself, well, I want to target this behavior. My son is lining up his cars. And the first thing I asked you to think about is why? And if what your answer is, and don't hide from the answer, if the answer is, it makes me nervous, bless you. And I'm putting my arms around you and hugging you because you were honest and admitted, it makes me nervous because I don't understand it. But then I'm going to ask you to go right on that for yourself. What am I worried about? Why does that frighten me? And you'll come up with answers. Everybody's answers will be different. It might be, well, I saw my Uncle Harold do that, and then he had a terrible life. And then you know, okay, well, then that's what's bugging me. And we're going to work hard to make sure that my child doesn't have my Uncle Harold's life, right? So whatever it is, write it out, get to the bottom of it, separate your child from what the anxiety is from you, right? Whenever we're working on behaviors with individuals who are on the autism spectrum, with anyone really, but let's talk about autism. It's ethical only when we think about it from their point of view. And when we say, how does this benefit them? How is this hurting them? There are self-stimulatory behaviors that can harm an individual. We have people who peel their skin. That's harmful. They get down to the point where their skin is bleeding on their hands. That is harmful to them. But it is a need. And we have a responsibility to fill that need in a different way. They've had luck with, but you have to understand what it is, first of all, because if it's a need to peel, they've had luck with, you know, how we used to take Elmer's glue and stick it on our hands and then we would peel it off. But instead of teaching that to that individual, they've taken it and stuck that on a doll and let them peel the glue off the doll. And then eventually they transfer that to something else, like making baklava, because it's peeling the layers and putting butter between them, right? There are lots of different ways to do this, but sometimes it's because there is an itch and that is why they're appealing, and doing the baklava would not work, right? So if it's an itch, we got to take care of the underlying medical thing first. Yeah. Perseverance. Yes. I like that word. So it's only ethical working on these behaviors when we are considering the individual, what is best for them, what will make them happy, what is right for them. Sometimes this is a harder conversation because we're having to deal with society and society's perceptions for things. But if the only reason why you're trying to change the behavior is because other people are saying it's weird or odd or don't want to play with your child, it is incumbent upon us as a society to make an attempt to teach those people a different way. I've talked so much about two summers ago when they did Big Brother, and the guy who had won Big Brother before and came back into the house because it was all people who had won before. And the first time he was in there, he did not disclose that he was on the spectrum. The second time he came in, he said, I'm on the spectrum. And we all know there are people who say, oh, I don't attach a stigma to that. And yet they do. And his thing that he did to soothe himself is that he would rock. And there was a lot going on in that house that would make him rock. And he rocked pretty intensely. And they sat it around in a room, all the neurotypical people, they sat around in a room and talked about how it made them feel when he rocked, that it made them nervous, that it made them anxious, that it made them feel weird, that they didn't feel comfortable. And while they were sitting talking about it, one of them was bobbing her foot up and down. One was compulsively petting her hair, going, it makes me nervous, right? And I would have given anything to have been in that room and said, what are you doing right now with your hands? What is that? It's making me nervous. I don't like it when you touch your hair. I feel weird inside. I don't like it. So that they could begin to understand it's a behavior. It's not going to hurt you. He's not going to hurt you. It's a behavior. It's something that he's doing, and you're doing something else that makes me think you're a dumb blonde, because all you're doing is petting your hair and it's making me crazy. And when people feel like, oh, I don't want to be stigmatized for doing this, right? This is what I do when I'm nervous. I want you to meet me with compassion. I'm not someone who should be pigeonholed for my blonde hair as not being smart. I have a PhD. This does not make me dumb. But then they start to understand, oh, that's exactly what I'm doing to him. I'm saying he rocks, therefore he's weird, odd, he doesn't deserve to be around me. It's a behavior. And we do have a responsibility as people who love individuals on the autism spectrum to try to educate up other people. But that starts with us. We have to embody that first. And so we have to, and you're going to have feelings. Your child is going to engage in a behavior at some point that's going to make you nervous or make you feel odd or make you feel, I don't know, weird isn't the word, but maybe. But then you have a responsibility to look within yourself and say, why? Now, it may also be that that behavior is preventing your child from being in a classroom. It may be that it's preventing your child from learning how to write. Well, I loved that we had the rabbi who was on who said, what's wrong with rocking? You know, rabbis rock when they're singing. What's wrong with rocking? Why take away the rocking? And my song is, no one should ever take away the rocking. But if what you want to be is a surgeon, you're going to have to learn that you rock during this time and not during surgery. And if you don't want to be a surgeon, rock all you want, right? But if your dream in life is to be a surgeon, then we got to find other ways besides rocking. And that's my song about that. Okay, so how do we work with a team of people when they're not getting this, whether it's the school, the teacher, the OT, the speech and language pathologist, your ABA provider, one of the therapists on your team who doesn't get this? If you see someone who is punishing your child for a stim, if they have completely removed a behavior and said that's not appropriate, if it's in school, you want to put a BIP in place. That's a behavior intervention plan. And that means that first they have to figure out what the function of the behavior is, and then they have to put in a whole strategy that gives your child rewards for doing other things, all the things that we've talked about, right? But we do not allow anyone on the team to punish your child for the stim. Now, sometimes people get confused about, well, but you said to give them the big treat if they didn't do it in the store, and if they don't, if they go ahead and do it anyway, that we leave the store and they don't get the treat, that's a punishment. It isn't. It's a cost response, which is a different thing. Punishment is that I took away from you something that you already had. If I've offered you a reward for something, if you do a certain behavior and I don't give it to you, that's a cost response. That's different from punishment. I've offered you something that was above and beyond. I hope that makes sense. But we never punish for self-stimulatory behavior. We just don't do it. It's not effective. You're going to want to, because if there's something that your child is doing, like sticking their finger in a light socket, you're going to want to punish. But I'm telling you that that's been found to not be effective, that we would want to block that behavior. We would want to reward other behavior. We would want to make sure that they're safe. We would put things in that would make it harder for them to stick their finger in their socket, but we don't want to punish them for a self-stimulatory behavior ever. Not effective. Science has shown not effective. But let me also say that there is a class of behavior that's particularly troublesome with these automatic reinforcing behaviors, and that's self-injurious behavior. That all self-injurious behavior is not automatic reinforcing. In fact, a lot of it is attention seeking. It's why you need to be working with an expert who can tell you the difference between the two. Very hard on your own to know the difference. If you see self-injurious behavior, they're hitting themselves, they're cutting themselves, they're harming themselves, you really don't want to be messing with that by yourself. You really need expert help. And pretty much everywhere in the world, expert help is available. You could run the risk of making it infinitely worse if you try to do it on your own. But even with self-injurious behavior, if it truly is automatic reinforcing behavior, they've had great luck in changing that. Okay, so you don't have to be stuck with that. Sidonia says, we all have something, I believe, but the titles have stigmas attached. Beautifully put. Yes, let's get rid of the stigma. Okay. What can we do to destigmatize stimming behaviors? Again, I think with love, when people are asking questions or saying, you know, they're stimming, that, you know, the first thing to do is to say, but we all stim, right? You stim, don't you? And a lot of times people go, no, I don't stim. I don't do that. And I'm kind of cutthroat and in your face, and sometimes I'm too much for people, but I will say, well, what's that thing you're doing right now? What's that? And that's really in your face. I don't recommend that everybody do that, because you'll get a rash and a crap back. I don't care. But when people are talking about somebody else's stim, I'm right up in their cheese pointing out theirs to them. I don't know that it's necessarily the kindest way to do it, but it's effective for me. But then they hate me and I don't want you to be hated, right? But you could do something a little more passive aggressive and say, well, I know some people that pet their hair and just look at them. Or I know some people that bob their feet up and down while they're doing it. Or I know some people who click their pen. Those are all self-stimulatory behaviors too. And we don't stigmatize them for it. So can we go back to working on this in a way that's productive? But if you really find that it's you have a teacher or a therapist or somebody who really just does not want to see it from an empowering the individual point of view, I got to say to you, don't invest a lot of time in them. Find somebody else. You know, go to their superior and say, here's the point that I'm trying to make to them. Now, one last word that a lot of times parents will use this as an excuse to let their child do whatever they want. This is also not kind. This is also not empowering. There is a dear person in our community that I think feels ostracized now, a parent, because they are known for this kind of behavior, that when their child engages in these kinds of behavior, the parent goes, well, that's autism. It's not. That is not autism. We all engage in self-stimulatory behavior. So it's not autism. And, you know, when your child takes food, not only, you know, off other people's plates, out of their mouth to put it in theirs, that's not autism. When your child takes other people's devices and runs away with them, that's not autism. And the mom, you know, says to people at school and people around her, well, I don't want you, you know, he's expressing himself. I don't want you to intervene in that. I fear for this child's life because that's a pathway to prison or being locked up someplace. That is not kind. That is not compassionate. Deciding not to teach people is not kind and compassionate. Saying, well, all they ever want to do is this, so we're not going to teach them how to use a pen, is not compassionate to me. I don't agree with that. So it's a very fine line. We need to be mindful and compassionate and considerate about the individual's needs. If we are intervening so that they can learn things that we and they have determined are important to them, then, you know, we do that with compassion and finding a way for them to get their needs met that's as good or better. Yeah. Parker says, I need to say this. Not all stimming is bad. I rock and I feel fine, but there are dangerous stims, including headbanging and picking scabs. Absolutely. There are some stims we should just leave completely alone and allow people to engage in what they need to engage in because it's what they need right now. And it's not hurting them and it's not hurting anybody else. And it's not preventing them from learning. Leave it alone. Leave it alone. But if it is hurting them or it's preventing them from learning or preventing them from being around others who are learning, then we might intervene. And then we would do the things that we're talking about here. But Parker, I think that was so well said. So now, if this has given you a new perspective, I have homework for you. Not only do I want you to look at your behavior and your child's behavior in this different empowering way, but I want you to find someone to share this with. Now, it could be that you sit down with your significant other and say, I watched this thing today and I'm looking at this in a different way. It could be that you talk to your BCBA on your team and say, I'm looking at this in a different way. Can I ask some questions? It could be that you share this with somebody, but we need for the word to get around to everyone that stimming is not something that we should stigmatize. And it's also not something that we should just say, well, that needs to stop. Just makes no sense, right? So your job today, if you got anything here, whatever you got, share it with at least one person. And if you can, share it with more people. deal. All right. We are back tomorrow with Ask Dr. Doreen, and you guys can be writing into her even more questions that you have. So I appreciate you being here. I know sometimes this has been a sensitive subject. Sometimes this is hard, and you're doing a great job. You're here. I appreciate you. I will see you tomorrow. Until then, give your kiddos a hug from me and one for you too. Bye-bye for now.